Thank you so much to the organizers for inviting me to come talk to y'all. I definitely think that in this crowd, I fall very strongly under astronomer. And whereas when I talk at astronomy conferences, a lot of people think of me as a gravity person, which is kind of funny. Because in this context, it's like a total farce for me to say anything about knowing much about gravity. But I'm really excited to talk to y'all today about some of the interesting and exciting work that's been coming out of the astrophysics side of trying to explain and understand where all of the binary black holes that LIGO is observing merge across the nearish universe, to basically share a bit of what we understand about where they're coming from or where they could be coming from. Since many of you probably don't know who I am, I just want to give a brief overview of like what I think about, just to sort of frame where the talk is coming from so that it makes a little bit of sense. I sort of split my academic self into three categories. A large part of what I work on is a binary population synthesis tool called COSMIC. And our goals with developing this tool is to produce open and accessible software that everybody can use and also creates reproducible results, because that wasn't always the case in binary population synthesis work. I've been thinking more recently very much about astrometric and radial velocity black hole binaries, and I'll talk a little bit about this at the very end of the talk, but the gist is that I'm very interested in trying to find and understand black holes that are orbiting stellar companions at intermediate evolutionary phases of the binary evolution, rather than just observing two black holes. And then, of course, part of the reason why I think I was asked to talk to y'all is that I focus a lot on gravitational wave populations. And I specifically, instead of think about how to detect gravitational waves or do inference or any of that, I really view gravitational wave populations as a tool to understand binary stars. And so all of this comes together to ask the question that really my broad, the question that I want to answer when I do research is, can we constrain the outcomes of binary interactions? And as I sort of alluded to, we developed these codes. Recently, we just put out on the archive, like 2 days ago, a globular cluster code, mostly led by Carl Rodriguez, that actually calls my binary evolution code to evolve stars in globular clusters. So this is a huge focus of our research. And if you're interested, you can check out all of our code and documentation. Of course, I don't necessarily expect everyone to do so, but it exists. And if you know people who are looking to make binary stars and black holes and globular clusters, now you can point them here. When I'm thinking about galactic stellar mass black holes, this really is literally just bright stars orbiting a dark object that we will find with telescopes like SDSS5 and Gaia. And then specifically, when I'm thinking about doing astrophysics, I actually think a lot both about LIGO, Virgo, black hole and neutron star mergers, but my true first love was actually LISA. And you can kind of see that if you look at the evolution of how I've been working, I've been getting closer and closer to things that are actually going to happen within the decade, because it turns out that to get a job in astronomy, you can't only talk about things that are coming in 2035. So for today, most of what I want to focus on are these LIGO-Virgo black hole mergers. It still is a bit staggering to me that as a junior scientist, we have gone in 5 years from having no gravitational waves and many people in the field not believing that LIGO might actually see anything to 47 binary black hole mergers. It's a little wild. I started a PhD with like, there was a lot of potential, and I finished a PhD with like, wow, there's actually really some interesting, exciting science to be doing with all of these mergers. Another thing that's quite funny is that we've started to get so many mergers that we can't really call them like beautiful names anymore, because they have these enormously long phone numbers. So it's funny sometimes to be talking to people about which merger and that, because the numbers just are terrible. But in any case, we live in the future. We have 47 binary black hole mergers in the Gravitational Wave Transient Catalog 2 that was recently released. Hopefully, over the next couple of months, we'll get the results from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration 03B run, and this is probably going to add something like 30 black holes to this catalog. The overall results that we know so far that the LIGO collaboration is willing to say for sure is that there are 50 mergers total. So that's there are 47 binary black holes and then one binary neutron star and two that are kind of like iffy because it's quite difficult to tell if you have a neutron star black hole binary or not. But the definitive results are first that black holes with masses greater than 45 solar mass exist in our universe. I'll explain a little bit why that's not necessarily a given just from stellar evolution. And the other big result is that spin measurements suggest the presence of multiple formation channels. And what that means is that the binary black holes that LIGO observes to merge are unlikely to be coming dramatically from just one channel. It's not just binary stars. It's not just globular clusters. It's not just primordial black holes. It's probably several that are contributing. Some more interesting results that have just very recently come out are that population analyses are starting to show interesting trends in the data. So this is a figure from Tom Callister's recent work that shows a very robust correlation in the mass ratio of the binary black hole mergers with their effective spin, chi effective. This is very recent. We actually don't really have a good sense for why this is happening or what channels could produce this correlation, but we at least know that it's there. So that's, it's exciting. There's lots of things to do. For me personally, the biggest challenge in using gravitational wave populations to study binary evolution is figuring out which ones come from binary stars. Because there are so many channels and formation environments that could make binary black holes, a lot of effort needs to go in to figure out which of the binary black holes that LIGO is observing are actually tools that I can use to understand binary stars. And really, there are an innumerous number of formation channels. I have deliberately not put citations on this slide because if I did, the whole slide would just be filled with citations because every single person who's ever thought about a formation channel has written like 10 papers because we're all extremely excited and we all have data to work with. But broadly, formation channels sort of are divided on whether the binary black holes were formed in isolation or have been brought together by some dynamical encounter. And so in dynamical formation, one of the first ways of thinking about doing this is just young star clusters, that's YSC, globular clusters, and nuclear star clusters. And these are just very dense stellar environments where stars and black holes interact with each other on very rapid timescales over the time of the globular cluster evolution. So it's those dynamical encounters that bring the stars together. There are also AGN disks where you could even imagine an interplay of the AGN disk around a supermassive black hole with a nuclear star cluster embedded in that AGN disk. This is an extremely complicated dynamical environment, but turns out could be a very good way to bring binary black holes together. You can just have few body encounters as in star clusters that are not particularly tightly packed. And we know that triple stars exist in the universe. We see them all the time, and triple dynamics can absolutely bring binary black holes close together to merge. So those are all dynamical. On the isolated side, the binary black holes could originate just from fluctuations in the early universe that collapse into primordial black holes and eventually merge. They could come from the very first stars that formed in the universe at zero metallicity. I've separated those out from standard binary stars because we think that the evolution of those stars is very, very, very different. And then there is this interesting chemically homogeneous channel where the stars are massive and very close together such that the tides actually spin up the star. And instead of a star burning through its nuclear elements, like you would imagine a star normally does, the star is fully mixed. And so it doesn't actually puff up as much as normal stars would. And therefore you sort of get around losing stellar envelopes to make fairly massive black holes. If you have any questions about these, you can definitely feel free to reach out to me in the Slack or anything like that. I'm not gonna go much more into detail there. But punchline, there are tons of them, tons and tons of ways to make binary black holes that LIGO could observe to merge. Luckily, each formation channel produces different rates as well as different combinations of gravitational wave observables. And so when we're thinking about trying to piece together which black holes come from which formation channels, these are the parameters that we use to try to distinguish between them. In particular, there's the chirp mass, which is what LIGO measures very, very well. There's also the mass ratio, the distance or redshift. LIGO measures the luminosity distance. If we get an electromagnetic counterpart, we also will observe a redshift from light, which is a fantastic tool for cosmology, but it's not always the case that we get to have that. Currently, LIGO is not searching in their templates for eccentricity at the moment. The reason for that is, of course, that building waveforms for an entire eccentric template bank is not an easy task. And so we understand that it's totally fair for them to not be doing that at the moment. And then there is this effective spin parameter, chi effective, which is the mass weighted spins projected onto the angular momentum axis. So for the next little while, what I want to do is just briefly go through different ways in which the formation channels could imprint themselves in the binary black hole observables. So in particular, if we look at just the data simulated from isolated binaries, which is cosmic, and globular cluster binaries from CMC. And I'm just showing you the primary mass, so the more massive black hole, and then the mass ratio, which is the secondary mass divided by the primary mass. One very specific feature that arises from isolated binary stars is that pair instability supernova creates a very hard cutoff at 45 solar masses. The reason that this happens is because massive stars with masses like above 100-ish solar masses, they have extremely hot cores, and those hot cores are emitting gamma rays, which can stochastically sort of produce pair production. And in doing so, that takes away radiation pressure from the gamma rays that are holding the envelope up. When that happens, the envelope collapses down and it can potentially ignite oxygen in the core of the very massive star. If you ignite oxygen in the core of the very massive star, you literally obliterate the star altogether. So if a star is massive enough, it will not produce black holes above 40-ish, 45 solar masses. And this is a very robust stellar evolution result. However, you can see in globular clusters, they are absolutely allowed to pass this limit. And that's because in dynamical environments, you can have binary black holes that merge and then encounter another binary or another black hole that forms a binary again and merges again. So this repeated merger scenario is one fantastic way to generally separate out dynamical versus isolated formation scenarios. We're pretty sure that isolated formation from stars is not going to give you a 45 solar mass black hole. That's particularly interesting because LIGO has told us there are greater than 45 solar mass black holes, so they can't all be coming from stars. Another thing that dynamical interactions can do is in dynamical interactions where you exchange partners, you always inject eccentricity. This is sort of known as Hege's law across the field, but you also randomize black hole spins. And so instead of in the case for binary stars where you are born together, your spins align with the orbital angular momentum, you have spins more or less close to along the angular momentum axis, chi effectives for dynamically formed binaries are quite separated along symmetric across chi effective equals zero. Between these interactions, gravitational wave emission is really mostly the only thing that's working on the binary black hole. So it just shrinks and circularizes your orbit until the next interaction happens. You inject the eccentricity again. In isolated binaries, you can have some injected eccentricity and spin misalignment when the black holes form. We're pretty sure that black holes are born with some amount of kick when they form just because of the angular momentum change when you collapse to forming the black hole. If there's a lot of ejecta in that black hole formation, you can actually have fairly strong natal kicks that are on the order of 100 to 200 kilometers per second. In that case, you can partially misalign the binary, and then there can be some interesting spin orbit coupling. But generally, it's not enough to make a really strong observation in the LIGO data. And in one thing that's particularly interesting about dynamical interactions and how their eccentricity manifests is that the more interactions that you have directly correlates with the amount of eccentricity in the population. And so this is illustrated nicely in, oh no, I lost Kyle's citation. This is a paper from Kyle Kramer that predicts the binary black holes that come from globular clusters that will be observable by LISA. And what I'm showing here is that the eccentricity, cumulative eccentricity distribution for binary black holes formed in isolation versus those that are formed in globular clusters but then ejected and then merge outside of the cluster versus those that are repeatedly interacting inside of the cluster, they show very different eccentricity distributions that we should be able to distinguish. So isolated and dynamical, fairly easy to distinguish, I would say, if you use all of your tools. In terms of spin up, there have been some really interesting work that shows that tides could spin up the black hole progenitors. A big question in isolated binary evolution is how, what is the magnitude of the spin of black holes when it forms? Part of the reason that this is very confusing is because when we write down stellar evolution theory, it seems like most black holes should be born not spinning particularly rapidly because of angular momentum transport in the star itself. But if you assume some prescriptions for angular momentum transport, there have been some nice studies coming out of the Geneva group with Tassos, Fragos, and Simona Bavera that are studying how much you could spin up a black hole progenitor along the way to forming your binary black hole. And in particularly here, they show that if the progenitor is tidally locked before the black hole forms, you might start to see some fairly distinctly large chi effectives. But of course, spin up can also happen in other formation channels. So in second generation mergers, when you merge two binary black holes together, that's going to create a very rapidly spinning black hole. If you continue to do this, we actually see that there is a significant spin up in binary black holes that form in migration traps in AGN. And the way that this works is it's literally just a trap in the AGN disk that where there's a massive, maybe 40, 50, 60 solar mass black hole, and black holes that are in the disk are transported to this migration trap to then come in and merge with the binary black holes. Those trap mergers have very strong signatures of being highly spinning. Their chi effective is not small, which means that the magnitude of the spins is quite high. Let's see, we've got a couple more. There are also ways to trace formation channels just based on the formation of the progenitors. So this is a really nice study from Ken Ng, who's a grad student at MIT. And Ken took a few different formation channels. He looked at globular cluster binary black holes, isolated binary black holes, and POP3 stars. And one of the defining features of POP3 stars is that since they are the first stars that formed, they should be merging at much higher redshifts than the stars that I think about in the globular clusters that the globular cluster folks think about. And so if you have a POP3 population, it actually turns out that we're not really going to be able to access it until future LBC data can access these higher redshifts. At the moment, LIGO's sort of stuck right around here, and really mostly here. It's very, very close, very, very nearby. Most of the redshifts are quite low, but there is future opportunities. Right after the release of Gravitational Wave Transient Catalog 2, a couple of groups started looking at multi-channel inference. So in particular saying, if I combine the isolated binaries that go through a common envelope isolated binaries that go through chemically homogeneous evolution, globular clusters, nuclear star clusters, and isolated binaries that undergo a stable mass transfer. You can compare each of these, you can compare the populations that we expect to see from each of them, and then make different assumptions for spins coming from globular cluster binaries. And then you can ask, if I choose a low spinning model, which is the blue curve, how much do I favor each of the formation channels? And so what that means then in this plot is if we have low spins for globular clusters, we favor the branching ratio of the common envelope binaries to be quite high. And then that makes all of these other channels be low. So there's fewer production, fewer black holes being produced in these channels, where there's more production here. You can do this with lots of different model assumptions. So if you do this then in the common envelope, you change a model assumption for this parameter, and you see the shapes of these distributions change, not particularly dramatically, but there are changes. So this is, I think, a promising way forward of trying to just understand which fraction of the population could be originating from each population. But as you can kind of see, this is a log plot, so it's very generous to the shapes of the curves. We still don't really have a good understanding for this. I think that this peak is probably not big enough to say anything particularly seriously. There's also some interesting developments in machine learning combined with hierarchical inference to inform relative contributions from formation channels. So this is the results of a paper that I was recently on with Kays Wong and Kyle Kramer and Tom Callister, where we just compared globular clusters to isolated binaries. And in the isolated binary case, we changed how much the black holes come together from common envelope in the black hole progenitor evolution. And in the globular clusters, we changed the initial radius of the clusters themselves, so how compact the clusters are. And Kays cooked up a really nice machine learning algorithm to actually interpolate between several different models that we generated for each of these parameters in alpha and initial virial radius. And then we compared that to the LIGO observations and to try to inform both the relative fraction of isolated binaries to globular clusters, that's what this F is, but also what parameters for the initial virial radius that we preferred. And one sort of unfortunate thing is that we basically didn't find anything out about the isolated binary parameters at all, but we did find that larger initial virial radii seem to be very preferred in the LIGO binary black hole data set. The other thing that we found is that we actually find that we prefer that only 20% or so of the binary black holes could originate in isolated binaries. So that's sort of a little bit opposite of what the previous study found. So I would say at the moment, we're very much in the Wild West mode with these mergers. With first 50 mergers, you can basically fit anything to anything. That's good for everyone who's like me, who's a theorist, who's coming up with lots of models, and we can still say that everything works, but I don't think that it's gonna be the case forever. 2021 is really only the beginning with gravitational wave astronomy. By 2024, there's going to be the Advanced LIGO Virgo Kagra network that's observing. It's observing again at these high ground-based frequencies. And in the third generation observations with things like Einstein Telescope and Cosmic Explorer, we probably will be able to reach those very high redshifts. So the number of binary black holes is not going to be tens, 20s, 30s. It's going to be more like hundreds to thousands. And in that case, we're going to really start to be able to say something. And then, of course, there's planned space-based missions. So specifically, the one that I'm very excited about is LISA, which is scheduled to launch in 2035-ish. We put ish on there because it's a long time, so things could slip. As we know, space-based missions tend to slip. There's also Tianjin, which is being led by the Chinese folks. And hopefully Tianjin will also launch on a timescale that is commensurate with LISA. And the main difference between LISA and LIGO is, of course, LISA is in space and it has enormous arms, while LIGO is on the ground and has quite small arms. What that means is that LISA is observing binary black holes in wider configurations with millihertz frequencies. And that's something like 20-ish minute orbital periods. Those binary black holes then, as they emit gravitational waves, shrink, circularize, and move towards the LIGO band to merge at kilohertz frequencies. That means that more or less every gravitational wave source that LIGO observes is passing through the LISA band. Whether or not those sources are observable by LISA is a different statement, but they are passing through the band. Unfortunately for humans, most sources that LISA will observe probably will not merge on human timescales. And the reason for that is just the timescales for gravitational wave emission. Most millihertz binary black holes are just evolving extremely slowly. So this is a figure that shows the chirp mass of the binary black hole versus its orbital frequency, which is more or less close to the gravitational wave frequency. And then I've colored the figure to show the time to merger of those binary black holes. And the punchline of this is that if you want a binary black hole to merge in the LISA observation time, you have to be along this solid white line. That's the very top of the LISA band. If you want the binary black hole to merge in 10 years, you don't really get to move very far because the gravitational wave emission equations just don't allow for that. Most of the binary black holes that we expect to observe are probably going to be hanging out around here because their merger times are slow. So there's sort of this pile up at lower frequencies where we expect most of the binary black holes to be hanging out. So in that sense, I like to think of ground and space-based observatories as being complementary probes. We are observing lower frequency binary black holes. We can observe their chirp mass with LISA. We can definitely observe their eccentricity. They're relatively nearby because at those lower frequencies, their signal to noise ratios are quite low. And we might be able to observe the spin, although it probably won't be the same chi effective that LIGO observes, just because at those wider frequencies, the spin orbit coupling isn't quite as strong. There was actually a really nice paper that studied case studies for how well LISA will be able to measure parameter estimation that just came out last night by Ricardo Busuccio. So I would definitely encourage folks who are interested to check that out. And then, so that's the LISA side. LISA is really the thing that LISA can do for us is measure that eccentricity. And that's because at wider frequencies, you just haven't radiated all of the eccentricity away. LIGO, on the other hand, is very good at measuring chirp masses, mass ratios, and spins. And because we're actually observing mergers, that gravitational wave signal is quite strong. And so you can observe the mergers quite far away. So LISA will sort of take over all of the very local black holes at wider orbits. And LIGO and future ground-based detectors will take over all of the really far away across cosmic time mergers. There has been work to predict what LISA will observe when it does fly. An interesting idiosyncrasy of forward modeling, where we start with stars and run them forward to produce what we think exists in the universe today. Because binary black holes spend something like 10 to the four times more time at 0.1 millihertz than at 10 millihertz, what that means is you have to simulate 10,000 more binary black holes at 0.1 millihertz to get one at 10 millihertz. And so that ends up meaning that we produce lots and lots and lots of binary black holes at low frequencies because it's just easy to generate them in our simulations. If we wanted to generate a full distribution of binary black holes here, we'd have to probably simulate on the order of a million galaxies to really fill out that distribution. And so computation time really comes in like a hammer, and we just mostly see low frequency binary black holes coming from those forward modeling. But it is somewhat optimistic. Within the galaxy, we expect to see something like 0 to 10 binary black holes originating from globular clusters and 0 to 10 binary black holes originating from isolated binaries. Of course, this stellar mass binary science case within LISA is maybe not binary black holes. It actually tends to be white dwarfs. And that's because, as you can see here, there are tons and tons. The white dwarfs are in blue. There are literally tens of millions of white dwarfs in our galaxy. So that's really what LISA is going to have a huge lever on. But there is potential for binary black holes coming from globular clusters and isolated binaries. An interesting thing that you can do is actually backward model instead, and it's a bit more optimistic. So what I'm showing here is the amplitude of gravitational waves coming from binary black holes that we assume start in LIGO, and we actually use gravitational wave emission equations to run the binary back in time for a certain amount of time to produce what we expect LISA to see. Because we already have those rapidly evolving black holes, it's actually easier to find where they live earlier in the band. So this is a helpful tool. This is a result that Alberto Sezzana put out right after the first gravitational wave detection. And he found really, really optimistic numbers. Unfortunately, with the release of Gravitational Wave Transient Catalog 2, the binary black hole merger rates have significantly reduced. And so the numbers have gone down. So that's maybe not as exciting. Maybe we'll have 4 to 20 binary black holes, but that's still optimistic, I would say. And the other thing that's really come into play is that there are many, many, many eccentric formation scenarios. And so LISA will play a large role even with a low number of binary black holes because of its ability to measure eccentricity. In particular, one of the studies that we did early on in my PhD was to see how well LISA could distinguish between isolated binaries and globular clusters. And what we found is that in the LISA band, where you can measure the eccentricities very, very easily at 10 to the minus 2, or rather easily at 10 to the minus 3. Ricardo's, the recent study on the LISA parameter estimation seems to point to this being very easy to do. All of these different formation scenarios, these are two isolated binary formation scenarios, they all seem to overlap in eccentricity and frequency, which was when we first wrote this study, we were hoping to see just very obvious separation in eccentricity. And it was a little bit sad as my first like real study to be like, oh, dang. But then it turned out that if we consider the systems for which LISA can measure chirp masses, the situation becomes much more exciting. And that's because formation scenarios don't just predict an eccentricity, they also predict a chirp mass. And in the case of what LISA could observe from these channels at 1 millihertz, the chirp mass and eccentricity comparison is what really distinguishes these populations. So this is definitely, I think, a very good, hot, I'm trying to think of the word. There's a lot of potential for when LISA flies to adding information to which formation channels are producing binary black holes in our universe. So for the last little bit, I want to bring back this particular challenge that I've been coming up against in my work, which is the biggest challenge in these gravitational wave populations and using them to study binary evolution is just that we really don't know which ones are producing which black holes are coming from binary stars. And so one thing that I've started to think a little bit more about is placing gravitational wave sources in the context of other compact object binaries. And in particular, since I produce binary evolution models, I know all of the intermediate phases that black hole binaries go through to produce close binary black holes that LIGO is observing. And in particular, if you have a binary black hole here, it necessarily had to go through a phase where it was likely an X-ray binary, and also a phase where it was detached earlier in its evolution. And since I have simulations that can connect each of these populations, I think that really, as someone who's excited about binary stars, this might be a really nice way of going about it. One thing to note is that different phases of this evolution call for very different discovery techniques. At wide separations, we can use telescopes, just like standard run-of-the-mill optical telescopes, to measure the positions and velocities of bright stars orbiting dark objects. We can use X-rays to observe potentially winds from these detached stars crashing into the black hole or stable Rochlov overflow accretion. But we can also use gravitational waves, of course, like I've been talking about. One thing that I'm particularly excited about is that for the two wider systems, we actually see them. We know that they're isolated binaries. So that's particularly exciting because this completely gets me away from all of the potential problems that I've just been talking about for 30 minutes, which is formation channels are really polluting all of the only isolated binary black holes that I care about. So for the last little bit, I just want to talk a bit about detached black hole binaries and the ways that we can try to observe them. As if we're looking for radial velocity black hole binaries, the idea is literally that we observe a spectrum from this bright star orbiting a dark object. We measure its radial velocity, and inside of this radial velocity measurement are black hole masses and luminous companion masses, along with orbital periods and eccentricities and phases. One of the punchlines of the recent studies that I did with Jeff Andrews is that we can actually constrain from our radial velocity observations the mass of the black hole quite well. So there's a lot of potential here. If we instead wait for Gaia to release its final catalog, we can measure the actual just movement of the star itself. And because Gaia also gives us a distance to that star, we lose the Sinai degeneracy that you normally get in radial velocities, and we can actually just back out black hole masses altogether, which is very, very exciting. So we're doing a lot of work right now to try to predict what Gaia is going to see so that when Gaia does see something, we know that it's seen it. And we're particularly excited because there are actually already two low mass black hole candidates orbiting red giants. In particular, they are very low mass black holes. If you think about the LIGO black holes having 5 at the very lowest, all the way up to 85 or 95, 3 is a totally different parameter space in terms of solar masses. So it's quite fun to be able to observe black holes across entire mass spaces. One of the things that we did in a study after this first candidate came out was we learned that the types of black holes that we're observing, these black hole plus giant stars, they have a very specific formation channel scenario that more or less follows this very defined path. They start out at zero age main sequence, just as two stars. They undergo a common envelope where the more massive star is at a very specific phase in its lifetime. So it's really, we've sort of isolated just one particular formation scenario inside of one particular formation channel. So there's a lot of potential here because we can study one single class of common envelope binaries and really understand the physics of what's happening in this particular formation scenario, which that was quite surprising and exciting for us. The other thing that we found is that the presence of these two candidates implies an enormous population that will be discoverable by Gaia. And the reason for that is because these low mass stellar companions are very cool in temperature. So they're observed primarily with the Apogee Telescope Survey, which is sensitive to really cool stars. Cool stars are low in mass. More massive stars are much hotter. And it turns out that black holes prefer more massive companions. And so Gaia being sensitive to hotter stars really ups the potential of Gaia detectable companions. So instead of maybe there being 2 to 5 that we predict in our galaxy of these black hole candidates that we've seen today, we're predicting hundreds with Gaia, just of that particular source class. So there's really a lot of potential here. And we also studied what the neutron star companions look like, and it turns out there's potentially several hundred of those. So we're very excited about the prospects here. So what I want to leave with is just this idea that as a binary evolution focused person, I see gravitational wave observations as a very particular and important part of the puzzle to understanding how black holes form, but it's only just one piece. And my ideal scenario is that as we continue to get observations of X-ray binaries and gravitational wave binaries and detached black hole binaries, we can use the things that we learn here to apply it to the other population and keep turning these lever arms back and forth until we really suss out what's going on. And with that, I will take questions. I see there's chat stuff that I wasn't paying attention to.
No worries. Thank you very, very much, Katie. I'll applaud for everyone here. And I already see some raised hands. And I think the question, well, yes. I think the first question was already answered in the chat. So let me just go straight into the people with their raised hands. Juan, do you want to go first?
Thank you for the very nice talk. So you mentioned about this mass gap, right? Due to pair instability.
Yeah.
45 solar mass bond. I think it's due to, let's say, early work by Woosley and others. But more recently, he had some refined analysis saying that if you take into account the model uncertainty, like one sigma model uncertainty, this bond can increase by, like, let's say, 20 solar mass or so. I don't know if you have read that paper, and are you going to take into account in your CMC or cosmic code?
Yeah, definitely. So that's absolutely true. There, the field of pair instability supernova is really like rapidly shifting. And you're right, Stan Woosley is totally the first person to put that stuff down in stellar evolution codes. With the shifting, there's a bit of me that feels a little bit allergic to chasing LIGO observations, because I think that just tuning our models to match the observations that LIGO is making is maybe not exactly what I want to do. But one of the things that's really great about population synthesis studies, which is different from detailed stellar evolution studies like Stan does, is we can take Stan's prescription, and where he says, if you assume this, you know, if you assume differences in the models, this is what you get instead. We can apply that to giant stellar populations and compare each of those models to try to predict what the differences are on a global population scale. So in that sense, yes, we are absolutely already putting these new prescriptions into the code. Whether or not I am fully on board that pair instability can get you all the way up to 60 solar masses, I think I'm a little bit hesitant to say yes for sure, because I think a lot of folks are really, a lot of people really want isolated binaries to be the dominant channel. And I understand why that's the case, but I'm not sure that I believe that that's the case. But yeah, that's a very long and winding way to say, yes, we are definitely putting those prescriptions into our code. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Wojciech, you want to go next? So your hand up.
Yeah, thanks. So a very interesting talk. I just wanted to ask about the information from the X-ray binaries. So if I understand the story correctly, the whole estimate of mass population from X-ray binaries kind of disappointed us in LIGO Virgo, right? By like a factor of 10, basically. So my question is, are these biases, you know, understood now, or is this problem overcome?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think more or less what I wish I had, I should have put this figure in as an extra, but when you compare the masses of X-ray binary black holes to what LIGO has observed, they are absolutely, they seem to be coming from a different class of sources. They're much, much lower in mass. And I think this tension is not necessarily something, I think it made people a little bit squeamish at first, but I think we're starting to really get more comfortable with the idea that there are different classes of black hole binaries. And so instead of saying that there's a tension between X-ray observations and gravitational waves, the truth is that gravitational waves are really biased towards finding massive black holes, and X-ray binaries are less biased, because what we can see in X-ray binaries and characterize is like the galaxy. And so the number of very massive 30, 40, 50 solar mass black holes inside of our galaxy is probably quite low. So it's maybe not so surprising that the X-ray binaries are picking up the more common lower mass black holes in our galaxy, and LIGO is picking up the rare, but it, from an enormous volume out in the universe of the massive black holes. But yeah, I think an interesting, there is this interesting interplay of these are the massive ones, these are the lower mass guys. And it's just because locally we really get into the low mass black hole statistics, and far away we get to really probe the tails of those black hole distributions.